For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right. For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you. That's right. For the record, lab on me going all the way. All the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. Stop calling. For the record, for the record, for the record, for the record, for the record. For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's
right. Welcome to Mount Woodgie Studios this afternoon. What a story of redemption I've got coming up. A man who at age 13 was convicted of murder, who was sentenced to years in jail, had a downgrade, was a heroin addict, a successful millionaire, Dean King. Welcome to the clink, mate.
Thanks, Brent. Good to be here, brother.
What a story of redemption. You really are a success in your own right. It's a very powerful story and something that you speak quite openly about these days.
Yeah.
And a walk that, you know, has defied all odds in reference to basically not being a statistic. Also addiction, heavy, heavy addiction.
Yep.
Dean, take us back. Who is Dean King?
Well, mate, that's been a process. When I was young, I was a wild kid. I just had no fear. I had no fear of the consequences for my behaviour and my actions. And I just reacted out of emotion, and I was wild. And
reacted out of emotion. So can I sort of go along the lines here of, and I don't want to make assumptions, but childhood was a bit tough growing up?
Yeah, well, I come from Balmain. I was brought up
Sydney boy?
Yeah, I was brought up in the inner city suburbs of Glebe, Piermont, Balmain, and you had to be tough.
That was predominantly your wharfy sort of, places of living, wasn't it? The blue-collar worker?
Yeah, yeah, pub on every corner. Forget about Mandalay Bay or pay TV. There was a fight every night.
Yeah,
and that's pretty much your benchmark is how good you could fight and how good you could stand up for yourself. I just integrated into that, and that's all I knew. And I kind of took that in later years, and I realised as time evolved that kind of stuff didn't apply in, other relationships with people that haven't lived like that, or, females, or just normal people in society.
13, mate. You've just pretty well come out of puberty.
Yeah, yeah.
You're a young bloke, obviously, knocking about the streets at that age.
Yep.
You're arrested on a very serious matter.
Yeah. We were knocking off dope plants out of some guy's backyard. And we were there, and we needed a knife to cut them because they were so big, the plants. And I was next to my co-accused, and he was putting these large heads in my forearm. And I heard a noise. I seen a silhouette because it was so dark. And I seen this white body coming out. He was completely nude, and he had two objects in his hand that I later learnt that one was a baseball bat and the other one was an iron bar. And I run, being a kid, I run to get out of there. And I went to jump over a fence, and I copped an iron bar on the back, and I fell down into a veggie patch that he had in the backyard growing stuff. And I was knocked out, and I awoke to watch him and my co-accused fighting. And evidently the co-accused stabbed him to death, and I jumped up and bolted.
Mate, I think for any young person at that age, you're there to knock off some mole plants. And look, just before we go any further, I just want to make this quite clear for our listeners out there. The clink does not glorify any crimes, and we all respect that there are victims and there are triggering points in all stories that may come that you listen to from the clink. But remembering, this is Stories of Redemption, and we do deliver the honest truth of each guest that we have on, and we make sure that we bring their story to light to why they have a story of redemption.
Yep.
Going back to you, the 13-year-old that's just woken up to a scuffle and a person being stabbed. I mean, you didn't obviously know at that stage that the person had passed?
No, I didn't. I didn't know that until the police rode at my house the next day. But I heard moans coming out of him. So
he was in some trouble.
He was in a bit of bother. Yeah. I was awoken the next morning. My father was listening to John Laws, and he relayed the story to me. There's a big bang on the door, about 30 police officers come into the house. They come upstairs. I was asleep. They woke me up. They seen the big welt on the back of my back. And they had a lot of information prior to coming to my house about who went there that night. And, went to Balmain Police Station, and I gave probably 5 different records of interviews. I was trying to get out of it. And in the end, they presented evidence to me that it put me there. So
when you say that it put you there, I mean, look, there's a golden rule, obviously, in the criminal life, is we don't make statements and we don't, you know, talk out of school. Mm. You're a 13-year-old boy who's just been told that... you know, they're putting you at the scene of a murder. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
You're obviously no idea of what the fuck's going on, really, or what's going to happen.
Well, I didn't, and I remember when the detective said, "We're now charging you with murder, Dean." My first response to that was, "I'll just plead guilty to that." And he said, "You don't understand, Dean. There's only one sentence for it. No one pleads guilty to murder."
And well, it was 10 years. It was brick, basically. It was life.
Yeah, it was life.
That's right.
And I couldn't even comprehend that as a kid. Like, I didn't know there was only one sentence. Who's going to plead guilty to that?
When you're interviewed back then, because we're going back many, many years, and the laws have changed, obviously, for juveniles, especially today.
Yeah.
Did you have to have a parent or a guardian there when they were there questioning you, or was it just basically they were adamant that they had enough evidence to support you as the person that actually committed the crime or was a part of the criminal?
I had my dad there.
Yep. And how was he at that time?
He was pretty shaken up, looking back in retrospect. He didn't know how to handle me, nor did my mother. I was a real young, wayward kid. So, yeah, he was very distraught. I remember... because we were there from like 7 o'clock in the morning to 6 at night.
Yeah, right.
So it's a big day, you know.
Huge.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, they finally come in and said, "We're now going to charge you for murder." And I turned around and said, straight away, I said to my father, I said, "What do I do, Dad?" And, you know, the poor bastard, you know, like he's just there to do his best. He's turned around and said, "Fuck do I know, Dean. You'll have to sort
so
it
Dad,
out."
So Dad wasn't of a criminal element or anything like that?
Knockabout
bloke.
Yeah, but nothing like what I was doing.
Yeah.
You know, like or what we've experienced. Yes. Like he never spent years in that locked up, but he was an old wharfie, you know.
Okay, knocking
shit off the wharfs, you know, like knocking bloody hams off from Pemulwuy's and cheese and bloody tomatoes, you know.
There's shit to live on, basically, well, back then, well, we had, doing your best.
We had no money. You know, so...
I think, too, Balmain back then, quote me if I'm wrong, would have been a little bit more of a hard-working sort of suburb, that Glebe area, not as yuppie as it would be today.
Oh, mate, it's chalk and
you
cheese.
Don't get there unless you're rich and famous these days, do you? Or you know someone that owns a restaurant in Lygon Street or something.
Yeah.
Like, you've got to be special.
Yeah, exactly.
No offence to anybody that's bought a property there for $100,000 that's worth $2.5 million now.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, kudos to you.
Yeah, exactly.
And look, let's be honest, there was a lot of tough coppers around back then, especially in that district.
Yeah.
And a lot of corruption.
Yeah, heaps.
Everybody was on the back end sort of thing, wasn't they?
And they all took a slip too, you know. Mm. They all took a drink. You know, you could buy your way out of things.
No option to buy your way out of this one?
No, not this one, mate. This is this was up there.
So with that, you obviously were around the drug scene of smoking pot and that back then. Were you drinking and stuff like that?
Yeah, I wasn't a real big drinker. I liked the pills, the barbiturates, the reds and the Turinol. Mm. And the Mandy's, acid. I love the acid.
You're still a fucking tripper today.
I'm in good company.
gotta know one first, you reckon? Two spinners in a pod.
It takes one to know one.
Well, that's what they reckon. Yeah, thanks, man. I left that door open. Right.
Yeah, you did, mate. Yeah.
So, yeah, getting back to the actual fucking story, mate. Coming in spinner.
Yeah.
So, yeah, all right. Well, Dean's hit with a murder charge and Dad's gone, well, fucked if I know, Dean, what we're doing.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk about the reality of that and how that sort of, because, I mean, I don't care who you are, that would have smacked you fair square in the mouth.
Yeah, but at that point in stage, it didn't. I didn't understand the enormity of what had happened to me because I was never held accountable for anything within my home environment. So I never really knew what consequences were.
From a disciplinary level sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, when you talk about, you know, redemption and changing your life, like I'm diverting a little bit, but I'll come to that.
No, you're
but,
right.
But no, yeah, so there was no really accountability or I wasn't held for anything because anything I did, you know, as far as my mum and dad was concerned, it was all everybody else's fault.
Yeah.
So to me, even being charged with a murder, that's somebody else's fault.
Yeah.
I didn't kill him, but I'm thinking I shouldn't be charged for this. And I probably shouldn't have been charged for it. But the reality was I was there. I was in association with that guy.
Well, it was technically a joint enterprise,
that's
wasn't
exactly
it?
Right. Enterprise. So I'm good for it. And, mate, as you were saying earlier, mate, I've got so much, not compassion, but I feel for what happened to that guy these days. That's a big thing, man.
Yeah.
Somebody's life got friggin' taken that
over
night.
Over a plant, man. Yeah.
You know, like, honest, mate, Brent, that was a bad thing that went down that night.
Yep.
But at that point in stage, I didn't see it as such.
I did recently an interview with Mahmoud Fazl on one of their podcasts. He's a wonderful journalist that's been on The Clink. And they asked me the same thing. We were talking about, you know, my childhood and the violence and me being extremely violent as a young person. And, you know, was there ever a thought of redemption? And what was redemption? I was a kid from the streets that was, you know, abused and fucking had nothing. Had been torn for shreds. My only way of living in the protection of my own person was to be violent.
Of course.
I didn't have a conscience because, as far as I'm concerned, everyone was out to turn on me.
Exactly.
In your sense, you know, you weren't sort of much different from that in hindsight, obviously.
Exactly the same. You know, I'd been to a home prior to that, so I've been through the system.
So how old were you when you actually started your criminal career?
Well, I was about 11 and a half. I quite enjoyed the attention. I quite enjoyed, you know, the police and taking the piss out of the police and having a laugh. And see, it was all innocent once upon a time. Mm. Even my drug taking was innocent. So there was a lot of innocence when I grew up. And that innocence became very real as my life evolved, you know. So, it all started as all play and taking the piss out of people and knocking off forklifts and, you know, having a shot at people and having a laugh. I've always been a larrikin.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're always good for a laugh, I'll give you that. and I will say you do. You always put a smile on my face whenever there's a frown, so thanks for that.
That's all right,
mate. Larrikin. Surely you were bail refused?
Yeah, I got bail refused at Yasmar.
Yes, wonderful Yasmar. Did you go to Minda or was it just Yasmar?
I have been to Minda.
Because Minda was the maximum security back then.
It was.
Before they opened up the wonderful Carryong, which is now Frank Baxter or something up there now.
Yeah, I did spend a few weeks at Minda.
Can I ask you something this is just a personal question because I personally experienced it so many others, and I mean back then it was rife, but was there any abuse towards yourself or any of the young people that you were around and with?
There was some sexual abuse.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was pretty rife. But there was a lot of physical abuse too. I look back on it now in retrospect because I've got children myself, which are 18 and 19. And, like, if those kids were treated the way I was treated, like slapped in the head, fucking backhanded, punched in the fucking face, thrown kicked in the ass, thrown across the room, treated like a bloody rag doll. Like, it's no way to treat a child.
No, but it was their way of their class of discipline.
Exactly,
you were being disciplined because
you're
out of control.
Exactly.
Parents couldn't control you.
Yeah.
So we'll fix that.
We'll fix that. We'll sort that out. Mm. And all that did for me personally, I just went, fucking fuck you. I didn't even get dirty on it. I just thought, yeah, is that the best you got?
It thickens you up. Like,
it thickens me, man.
You get to the point where it's thickened in a negative way. It doesn't thicken you up as a hardened person with a heart.
It
makes you cold.
I become desensitized.
Yeah. And no emotion.
No emotion whatsoever. But I didn't even understand, Brent, I was that separated.
Yeah.
I didn't even comprehend it. You know, the more years that I spent locked up in these institutions, the more angry I become, the more resentful I become, the more hateful I become, because I was so friggin' lonely.
Yeah.
I was so lonely with my soul. I remember I used to sit in prison cells like, 88, 87 at the end of it all. And I had all these complexes about myself. And I used to think, how the hell could I tell somebody that I think that I'm an ugly bastard? What are they going to think about me?
Yeah.
Or how can I tell somebody that I'm lonely?
Especially back then, because it's a weakness, isn't it?
Well, that's...
It's not a cry for help. It's harden the fuck up. You're weak.
Get on with it, bitch.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, and... But in saying that, I used to... Because I had a lot of go about myself, I could get away with a lot of shit.
Mm.
You know, I could muck around with people and take the piss out of them and show my heart to a certain extent. But more so, that's in that environment where I felt comfortable. But where I was stuck, I couldn't show that to normal people.
So on the outside,
yes,
where life should have
matters.
Been. Yeah, exactly.
And I couldn't get that. So I was stuck in that. Yeah, I could play around in that and have a joke with them and take the piss out of me and I'd take the piss out of them. But coming up against people that I really looked at and thought, why aren't I like that?
Yeah.
Why haven't I got a job? Why do I have to always come to prison? You know, why can't I work 9 to 5? Why can't I be with a girl that works at Coles or, you know, somebody that's not a heroin addict or somebody that hasn't been in homes and stuff like that?
Yeah.
And the reason why is because I wasn't capable of that kind of emotional commitment. That's what I'm assuming.
Yeah.
I wasn't capable of it.
The sort of brain had been deprogrammed rather
exactly.
than programmed.
Yeah, and it was deprogrammed to that kind of lifestyle.
Yeah.
And that's what I was stuck in. So.
Dean, how many years were you sentenced to off that initial major charge?
I got 5 years for that with a 2-year recommendation. I did 2 years for it.
Wow. Yeah. And the charge was eventually downgraded to manslaughter, wasn't it?
Yeah. And you know, like I got found guilty on saying in a record of interview, and I'm not proclaiming that I'm not guilty for this because I accept it, I was. Yep. But in the interview, the detective turned around and said, and what did the guy say before you went there who had the knife? And I said, he said if anyone would come out, he was going to kill him. But then he laughed. And I had heard that so many times, that somebody was going to kill somebody.
Yeah.
So I didn't believe that. And I didn't believe that was going to go down. But that proved intent. That what I knew...
Well, it was pre-knowledge.
That's right. But I didn't believe that was going to happen because I heard hundreds of people say, I'm going to kill this bloke, I'm going to kill this bloke,
yeah,
and it never happened.
No. And that's the thing, you know, on the street, especially, you know, in those days, fuck you, I'm going to kill you and come back and fucking stab you, shoot you.
Yeah,
just because, you know, you're having a row with someone or you have a knuckle and the bloke gets, you know, gets a bit of a touch-up, he's going to come back with his cousins, brothers, uncles, mothers, fathers, and they're all going to kill you.
Pretty much.
But that's you know, that's the reality of it, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You do your time.
Yeah.
What happens next?
Mate, I get out and I'm nearly 18. I'm probably about 17 and a half. I go back to Sydney. My parents move from Balmain to Riverwood.
Yep.
to give me a better life with better people and a different association up there.
How do you get that out of Riverwood, mate?
That's what
Riverwood
I was
no fucking better. If anything, it was worse between, you know, Riverwood and Padstow.
Gee whiz. I said that to my parents a few years later. I said, fucking Riverwood?
Wow. Yeah.
They said, well, we didn't know Dean. We lived up here years ago in the huts.
Literally, it's just across the old, what was it, Canterbury Road, basically.
Yeah, and pretty much.
You're jumping across Parramatta Road, Canterbury Road, and you're in Riverwood.
And I'm in Riverwood.
Stone's throw.
I know. So, yeah, so I end up there, and that's when I really got involved in heroin.
You really got involved in heroin, and we've talked about this before with other guests such as Russell Manser and... you know, a couple of others in reference to the eras and the addictions of people and, you know, the flood of certain drugs. Like, I mean, fuck, what it is today is an epidemic with this ice thing. It's just something that I've, you know, you can't, I can't, why you would go down that road anyway, knowing what it does, it just fathoms me. You know, growing up, heroin was still, you know, the cultural thing. Back in the late 80s as well as, you know, early 90s. I mean, I lost a lot of mates to the gear, and that was what you would see, predominantly just blokes and chicks on the nod, sitting there scratching. And
it was everywhere.
You know, you knew. As soon as you talked to someone, it'd be, you know, itching on the nose every 2 seconds and then pin, nah, I'm not stoned. I'm not stoned. I'm right. Right on, mate.
Yeah.
You know, so you're quite young.
Yeah.
And you're introduced to heroin.
Yeah. I loved it. I thought it was the best thing since sliced bread.
Was it something that you sort of took as just numbing of any pain or thought, or was it more just the high? Or what did you love about it?
No, nothing where I could cognitively join it all together. I couldn't do that. I loved how it took me out of where I was at, but being where I was at, I wasn't even really consciously. Thinking it was a real bad place anyway. Mm. It just took me to a whole new level, and I was really comfortable in it. And I liked, you know, the nod, and I liked the peace in it, and I liked the detachment from everything around me. I didn't use it for any conscious reasons where I went, oh, I got problems.
Living in a dream until you're hanging out, basically.
Pretty much. And then I'd go and steal and I'd freaking get some more. But it gave me motivation also. It gave me purpose. It gave me something to do every day.
Did you ever go through times there where you literally were hanging out to the point where
I'd always
make sure you had your fix?
Oh, always. I'd be out earning.
Yeah.
My father used to say, you know, you're the best hover I've ever seen, Dean. You just don't stop. I said, well, you get a heroin habit into your dad and say you're travelling. He went, pull up, Dean. He said, the piss is enough.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, at the end of the day, that'd probably be worse. Oh, wow.
Yeah, so, I never used it for that. But I never liked myself. There was always that element. I hated myself.
Do you think that had a lot to do with when you talk about detachment from, you know, the realism of the world?
Yeah.
Emotional. Do you think that was because, like we said, you know, a minute ago, your mental state wasn't developed in a positive social manner?
Most definitely.
You only became down upon yourself to the point where, like you say, you know, you hated yourself.
I did.
You hated the way that you were living, I guess.
Yes.
So, you know, if you're hating on all that, and there are things at that age that we should have positives in, you know, whether it be through social groups, sporting, a chick that's, you know... good to you, whatever it might be. Some have children at that age.
Yeah.
We're talking 18, 19, yeah?
Yeah.
You're just empty.
Yeah, completely. Completely empty.
So I get the point of you saying, you know, you loved the addiction, you loved the heroin, you know, you loved what you were doing because it was fulfilling, wasn't it?
It was. It
gave you a purpose.
It did give me a purpose. You know, I had something to do each day. And I liked doing that. I liked car chases. I liked... the thrill of not having money and the thrill of getting a lot of money and lurking. And
did you still ever realise, though, from your mindset that you were doing wrong, or was it like just a big game?
No.
It was just like fun and games because you were getting, like you said, that attention. You know, it was a rush because you're out there and it was like, you know, like I guess playing a video game and it's like, yeah, catch me if you can sort of thing.
That's how it was.
Catch if you can. In your book, we talk about a...
high-speed chase up in Brisbane.
One of a few in there.
Mate, let's talk about some of that.
All right, no problem.
Because we jump from Sydney, don't we, and you come up north.
Yeah, I do.
And
I went to Victoria first. I did a lagging down there in Pentridge.
Oh, all right. Well, let's go back to Victoria. Okay. Let's touch on Victoria before we come up to sunny Brisbane.
Okay, yeah.
And how was that? John Killick's told me quite a bit about Pentridge. He was there when the last man was hung. He was there through a riot. Let's hear about your story.
Yeah, I didn't mind it. I thought it was okay. You know, the Crims, they had go in them. When I first got there, I was in Russell Street for a month because the jails were overcrowded.
So can we just identify what Russell Street is for those out there that are listening that aren't sure? It was...
A watch house.
Well, it was a watch house that
got blown up by
you know, a couple of Crims. Well, and they I don't know if they were really good Crims, because from what I read, they were fucking... One of them in particular was a grub.
And they got found not guilty of it.
Police informant too. Yeah. And fucking, you know, sickoid murderer and rapist and...
Yeah.
And he was found not guilty.
They were, yeah.
Wow.
But I was in Russell Street for 3 weeks and... I was hanging out from the heroin, and they put this this Lebanese guy in the cell with me. And when we got locked up this first afternoon that he was two out with me, he started squatting over the toilet, and I thought, is he, your horse is off, you know? I said, what are you doing, mate? And he's gone, well, you'll see in a minute.
Oh, he had something in his safe.
Yeah, he had an ounce of pure heroin. Up his ass.
You're kidding
me. Ah, fair dinkum. And he had...
So did you just sort of beg him to keep you at the watch house?
Mate, I loved him. I loved him. I landed in Pentridge with the biggest habit.
Really?
I was sick as a dog.
He didn't give you a start to go with?
No. He probably would have got lucky.
Wow. So had he been given bail or anything?
He got out, yeah.
And you're stuck in there with a filthy habit. So you've just gone through your withdrawals and hanging out, and next minute, boom, you're back on the jackrabbit again.
Yeah. So I get to Pentridge, and it was a cold place. They put me in F Division. And the first night I was there, they put me in a...
What year was this?
This was in 83.
Right.
They put me in a dormitory, and there probably was about 120 blokes in this dormitory. And the toilets was at one end of the dormitory, and there was three toilets at the other end, and they were completely open. Mm. And people were there having a shit, and I was looking around, I was thinking, fucking, this is pretty full on in here.
It's the real deal.
Yeah, mm. And the bloke next to me...
So you hadn't been to real jail time as such, boys' homes?
Oh, I went to...
But no serious lagging.
That was really my first lagging in prison, in mainstream.
Yeah.
And I said to the bloke who was next to me, and he was on the escort, I said, fucking, what's the go in this joint? He said, oh, I've done a bit of nick here. He said, you just behave yourself and fucking watch yourself in here. He said, because you might get rooted. You're a good-looking young fella. I said, fuck, and I want to be fucking really willing these blokes. I won't say the word. Mm. And he said, oh, yeah, they're willing. And I went to sleep that night, and somebody knocked off my tracksuit. I had a blue Lecoq sportive tracksuit.
Oh, you could wear your own?
Yeah, you could wear your own clothes in there.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I was frigging, I couldn't believe that, because in Penang and all that, you used to wear khaki and
that's
all
right.
That.
Was it the blue, green, brown, or bronze?
So
the Gronk unit, Sebron, I think it was.
Yeah, and so I woke up the next morning, and that was gone, and I had a bread roll that I was going to chew on too, that I got from the survey prior to going in there, and that was gone too. I was dirty, and I ended up getting lifted from F Division over to D Division. I was there when about five blokes escaped from Jaika in 1983. And they all the screws went on strike because the minister sacked a few screws, and they named it Operation Bluestone. So yeah, I was down there through that, and I got on good with the Crims, and it was just another institution, you know. I've seen some good fights down there, and I've got a lot of stories about the joint, but I won't bore you with. There's a lot that happened down there.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But I was going to get stabbed. They were going to knock me.
So it was a dead set. It was
a scary environment to be in at that age.
Well, I wasn't really scared. I never identified with fear.
Yeah.
I was getting out on what they call a leave of absence because the jails were so full. They were going to let me out earlier. And New South Wales Police had been in touch with me and they told me that they were going to extradite me on a certain date. Mm. And a guy in the yard said, get up there and apply for LOA, leave of absence. He said, because they're letting a lot of crims out if you're doing 12 months or under. And I said, okay, sweet. I applied for it and I got it. And the lady from the administration, when she said, I've got it, she said, you'll be going on Saturday. Well, the copper's dates of taking me back was 2 months ahead. And I'm thinking, I might just fucking pull this off.
So had the warrant been issued? Did they know anything about the warrant?
Well, this is where I was at. I was stuck between a rock and a hard place. And I'm thinking, surely they've got that warrant on file. They're going to know.
Did you think you'd make the break, Bob?
I didn't know. And so I come to the front gates of Pentridge and they open the gates up and I think, oh, the coppers are here. And I walk outside, there's no one there, so I fucking bolt. I'm running down Sydney Road like a fucking champion.
Because that's in Geelong. That was near Geelong, wasn't it?
Coburg.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm running down Sydney Road and I get to a tram station and I caught a tram from there straight into Spencer Street.
Yes.
And then I rang up my father and I said, Dad, I'm out. He said, what? He started laughing. He said, those stupid fucking
coffers.
Did he
ask you, have you escaped, Dean?
No, he just said, the stupid coffers, they let you out, Dean. I said, yeah, I'm out, Dad. What do I do? He said, get fucking home. Yeah. And so I...
Back to Sydney.
Yeah. And so I freaking... I caught a train. I was north as far as I could, the last stop, because I knew that would get me somewhere near the Princess Highway. And I got off the train, and then I just started hitchhiking.
Really?
Yeah, and it's all in the book. It's funny stories. Like, when I'm talking to you, I'm thinking of the book.
Because
everything's in there, you know.
Oh, look, it'll be a great read for anybody, and we'll talk about that definitely as we kick on. Wow, that's fucking interesting. So you're hitching along the Princess Highway?
Yeah.
Coming from down south?
Yeah.
I got to say, that's... one shithole of a road. I've driven semis up and down that plenty of time, man. And there's one place in Australia I despise driving to Sydney to Melbourne.
Yeah.
It's a prick of a trip.
Yeah.
How was it back then and hitching?
Mate, it was like the golden mile for me because I'm going back to Sydney, you know.
You didn't care.
I didn't care. I just want to get home.
Did you, and I know this might be silly, but, you know, how was your habit at that stage? Were you clean? Were you healthy?
I was clean, yeah, fit.
But
yeah.
Did you have it on your mind that you wanted to go and have a shot, or was it something that you were just like not thinking of until it was in front of you at that stage?
Yeah, when it got put in front of me, I'd have a shot, but I'd smoke some pot, and a couple of hippies picked me up at Aubrey Wodonga.
Oh, fuck!
And it's a mad story, and they're smoking joints, and I got on the joints with them, and they had a kid, and he asked me, he said. Probably, I don't know, friggin' near Goulburn. He said to me, I'm pretty tired, man. Do you want to drive? And it was a V8 panel van, like HQ.
Like a Sandman or something.
Manual, right? And it had the big bloody eight ball on the top, right?
Well, the old Aussie four-speed.
Yeah, and he said, do you want to drive? Mate, I've got an erection. I'll drive.
Oh, you're a car thief since you're a little kid.
Oh,
hey,
mate, right? Yeah. And I hammered it. And... We get outside of Campbelltown and I was doing about 180 k's. I'm just flying, you know. It's like a big hover thing, you know. And he wakes up and he's looked at the speedo. He's gone, slow it down, man. What's going on? I've got my kid in the car. I've got the missus. I said, the accelerator's stuck.
Oh, fuck. Oh, dear.
He said, what? I said, I'm only joking. He said, oh, slow down, man. I said, yeah, you're all right, bruh. And I slowed it down. But, yeah, it's all in there. It's a friggin'
you game. You would have been very close to home if you were at Campbelltown. It would have been 40 minutes up the road. Maybe,
yeah.
Maybe a little bit longer back then. But.
Well, I had to actually go to Barella. My mum and dad were staying with me auntie out there and my uncle. So
you get home?
Yeah, I got home.
And what happened then?
Well, I got home and I was wanted in New South Wales, yeah. So the old man dyed me hair.
Is that why your hair's the way it is now?
Yeah, pretty much. It all fell out. And
I'll wait. No, I'll just let it go.
Yeah, let that one go to the bowl and let to the keeper. And
wide.
Yeah, like that. Yeah.
Your hair looks good, mate.
Thanks,
your hair
mate.
Looks really,
yeah.
really good these
yeah.
days.
Yeah, I think you've told them already.
I haven't said anything. Yeah. But just for the record, if anybody wants to know, Dean's wearing a toupee.
It's a good one too, isn't it? Yeah, the best money you can buy, mate, this one.
I reckon he'd be sexier if he took it off, but anyway.
I've had people say that to me.
But anyway, enough of the hair. Get yeah. back to the hairy parts of the show.
Yeah, and the old man dyes me hair friggin' white. He put that much peroxide on me bloody head, it starts burning me.
You've already got light colour hair yeah. to start with.
Well, I was wanted, so yeah. I wanted to change my whole look, you know. Mm. And, I got dirty about that. And I ended up down in Leichhardt, and I seen a few mates that I knew, and they used to call me Blue, and they said, what happened to your hair, Blue? I said, I've been surfing.
Because you're a bleach blonde.
Yeah. They said, surfing? We'll call you Whitey now. I said, don't get too fucking... I started getting dirty at them, you know.
But, how long did you last there before you needed to get going again? Well, did you get rearrested in New South Wales?
Yeah. And yeah. I got pinched for those charges, and I ended up back at the Bay, and I got 18 months.
Wonderful Long Bay, the good old SIP.
Yeah, and then I was in the MRP, and then I went up to Emu Plains. And then I got out. I didn't do so. I did about 15 or 16 months.
How old are you now?
I'm
early
20s.
Fuck off.
In the shade. I'm 56.
Back then, you boofhead.
Yeah. Oh, back then. Oh, shit.
When
oh.
you were going through this, how old are you?
Oh, I would have been 19, 20.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're well on your way to just a full criminal career at that stage. There was no...
Oh, yeah.
That's who you were going to be. You're a drug addict.
Yeah, drug addict.
Committing, you know, crimes left, right and centre.
Yeah. That's well. My ultimate goal was to be a good armed robber, because I'd lived with a heaps of armed robbers, and I looked up to them because they had a lot of go in them, and I liked the fact that they run into banks at that point in stage and held with guns and the power. I had an appeal to that.
Yeah.
And I probably would have ended up going down that track. I would have either got shot dead, or I'd be doing. A long time.
What stopped you?
Rehab.
Right. So is that rehab after you've come up to Brisbane and had your taste of the Queensland system as well?
Yeah.
What was that like? So you've gotten out and what, just decided to fuck off up here? Just
yeah.
Come up north.
I said to the old man, I was
like... Making urn up here. And
Well, I knew you could get methadone up here.
Oh, really? Well, how long ago was that?
Back in the early 80s.
So methadone, for those of you that aren't sort of up to date with it, it's predominantly given to, or was back then, for heroin addicts or anybody on opiates of any type that was wanting to get off or in withdrawals, wasn't it?
Yeah,
it was a clinical substitute, pharmaceutical.
Yeah, it's synthetic heroin. It's, as you say, it's a pharmaceutical.
So you get up here and you get on methadone, is that right? And so therefore, you know, you've got your dose every day.
Didn't pull me up much.
No, so you were still chopping in?
Oh, chopping in. I was still running a marker. Yeah.
Did you still get high, though, using methadone and heroin? Because I've heard conflicting stories, you know, like, and as I said, I know growing up there were people that were using and there was, it just wasn't, I know people that would sit there with cannons, double pumped cannons, you know, dosing up their methadone through their veins as opposed to drinking it.
Yeah.
With their takeaways, like you know, a bloke I know, I won't say his name. I don't even know if he's alive today, but he was just renowned for it. Yeah. Yaguna lad, that's all I'll say. But he wouldn't be much off. He's in between us in age, so he'd have to be around his 50s if he's still alive. And if he is, well, I'm fucked if I know how his body's tolerated it. But like, I mean, I was a kid. He'd just load up two cannons, big butterflies, and just feed his veins, and I. that was his, you know, like, I could be wrong, 200, 300 mil dose, something like that.
That's huge.
Yeah, it was fucking phenomenal.
Yeah.
The guy was just, it blew my mind, and I was very young.
That'd kill a horse.
So, you're up here on methadone.
I'm up here on methadone, and I'm still stealing cars, and I'm going out to nightclubs, I'm picking up girls, I'm having a good time, I'm friggin' stealing, I'm got heaps of money.
Not a care in the world.
Couldn't care less.
Yep.
Had no fear of anything. I was living in Fortitude Valley, and I'd met a good bloke up here.
Was Fortitude Valley back then also like the Cross in Sydney? Did it have that still that... Oh, there was a period there where it was the dirty parts of Brisbane, you know what I mean, where, you know, sort of Oxford Street, King's Cross style.
Yeah, to a certain extent.
Like Sydney.
No, nothing like Sydney.
I mean, St Kilda didn't even come close to it. The Cross was the Cross.
No, the Cross was the Cross. Mm. You know, like I spent quite a bit of time down in St Kilda, and yeah, nothing like Sydney, mate. No. I've seen some pretty violent things happen on that strip.
Oh, absolutely.
As a kid, I've seen some terrible kickings.
Yeah.
I've seen a bloke get stabbed to death there one night when I was young outside the pinball parlour.
Mm.
Yeah, I seen some...
It was pretty common back then, wasn't it?
Oh, like stock standard. Yeah. Stock standard. Like, you know, violence pretty much, you know, it ruled.
Yeah.
But
Brisbane didn't have that sort of...
Well, it probably...
Vibe, if you will. I hate that word, vibe.
Yeah, nah, here.
Vibing. I'm getting on your vibe.
It probably did... But it wasn't as showy
in your face as it was as blatant. Yeah,
apparently there was a lot of stuff with massage parlors you know, organised crime, right. and I met a lot of blokes who were connected in the nightclub scene and in the restaurant scene, in the horse racing scene.
Yep.
I always landed around pretty full-on people, you know.
But that was the go back then too. If you're an earner, whether you're a heroin addict or not,
yeah.
I used to see it growing up. I always hung around older blokes and, you know, it wouldn't matter where we go. You'd meet people in suits, you know, dressed well, immaculately, you know, cashed up, and you're knocking about with this bloody bloke that's just a scrawny little addict that is a big earner.
Mm.
And they'd be feeding him cash, looking after him.
Yeah.
Offering him, you know, nights in hotels, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Well, a connection.
I used to steal things for them too.
My point exactly. Things, yeah. You become their go-to guy, yeah, and exactly. If you're trustworthy.
Yeah, like I used to get them cars, or if they needed other things, I won't go into it, but I'd do it.
Yeah.
No problem. And it was good money, and it was consistent money. You didn't have to wait for it because they were all cashed up.
Yes.
So I used to like hanging around people like that. You know, you knew you did your thing and you got paid for it, and that was good. There was no muck around, or, you know, they're not people that say one thing and do the other. If they need
something. The man of word, so...
Yeah, if they need something and you produce that, they honour that straight up, you know. So I used to like that.
Did you hit Bogger Road?
Yeah, I did, yeah. I hit that in 84.
And what was, comparing it to H Division, or sorry, not H Division, you didn't get the H Division, but Pentridge, what, you know, and Long Bay, because Long Bay wasn't a nice place to be back then either.
No. I thought it was a holiday camp when I got there at Bogger Road. I thought, what's this joint? Like, they had a big oval and tennis courts when you pulled up at the reception and you got processed, and it was night time. But I was talking to Crims in the van, and I was talking to them at the Watch House in Herschel Street prior to going out there. And they were, to me, they were like squareheads. Yeah. You know, not many of them had go in them. They had go in them, but it was different to what we experienced,
yeah.
Full onness, you know. Yeah. Like, and I'm sure there's a lot of blokes that are full on in the system up here.
Absolutely.
But the general population, but that's a smaller amount to the general population. The general population, I remember when I first ever come to Queensland, a mate of mine said, "Now listen, don't be shocked, Dean." I said, "Why is that?" He said, "I'm going to take you to and you're going to visit a Queenslander now." I said, "Yeah?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "Be ready for it." And we were there, and we were in this big circle, and they were passing around the bong.
Mm.
And friggin' when it come to me to have a bong, they bypassed me and gave it to the bloke next to me. And I went, "What's going on here?" And Chris said, "Settle down, Dean. I told you they're Queenslanders."
What the fuck?
They wouldn't have fucking given me a cone. And,
are you serious?
Oh, tight bastards, you know?
Really?
Like, oh, yeah. And Chris said, don't go off here. Just
why, because you didn't chuck in for the sesh?
Yeah, I didn't chuck in for the sesh. I didn't get a cone.
Oh, wow.
And I said, and I just went, F off, Chris. And I got up and I said, fuck. And I started going
off. What do you say F off for and then fuck?
Ah, well, fuck off, Chris.
There you go. This is a fucking, mate. We don't need bullshit here.
Yeah, well.
You know, your common politeness and stick it up your ass, mate.
All right. Well, fucking now you're talking to me. I like this shit. Fucking hell. That's good.
Oh, and I can't even apologise, guys, because now if you're into Season 3, you've definitely listened to Season 1 and 2. There's no bullshit in the clink, so
yeah. That's
a beautiful thing about this podcast. It's I'm very proud of that people, you know, all our guests, they're all genuine, and you know, the stories, and as I said, you know, we're sitting here having a giggle, and we're not giggling at the actual the victims or anything to do with the
not
crimes,
at all.
But this is, you know, the truth of redemption, and we've got to go back and go through it, and I suppose when you look back on things now, you can't help but have a little laugh. I mean, other guests that I've had, you can't help it. There's some fucking funny stories. You know, there really is.
Yeah. And, like you know, your past is important. Like
it makes you who you are
it
today.
Does, man.
And, you know, like, you are a man that's actually worked very, very hard.
Very much so.
With your Brisbane sort of time, well, it wasn't really too many years of criminal activity up here, was it? You sort of really pulled your head in after, 5-6 years of being up here or something, was it?
Yeah. It was 89 that I landed in the rehab, but I did about 4 years up here.
But that's my point. You got up here, you had a good time for a short time, and the rest was jail.
Yeah, but in jail, I used to have a good time. I used to make the best out of a bad situation all the time.
Yeah.
Like, I'd always look on the bright side of life.
And you still do. I'll give you credit for that. That's something, you know, and we've known each other for quite some time now. And, you know, we've both been in some dark, dark places. And, you know, you'll still always fucking turn around and, oh, well, you know, smile and walk on, like, you know.
And, you know, like, I've had a lot of challenging times, you know. I've been an absolute multi-millionaire. And that's only a byproduct of who I am within my soul and what I've changed, you know. But, you know, I've lost a lot of money. I've had to deal with that. I've had girlfriends die on me in Bali, you know. I've gone through relationship breakups. I've gone through, you know, people robbing me in business.
Yeah.
I've gone through so many challenges. I could sit here all afternoon and talk about them. But, you know, I'm responsible for all that. I've been in all that. I applied myself in that. I put myself in all these positions. I'm not a victim. I'm not a, you know, poor me. I'm accountable. And that gives me that joy still within me. That because I'm so accountable for what I've done and I take ownership of it all, you know, the past is okay.
I think the biggest thing of redemption is acceptance of yourself.
Of course. You know.
If you can't, like you just said, you know, like people say to me, don't you have a regret? Well, yeah, I mean, my only regret is missing out on one of my four children's birth.
Yep.
Because I was in jail.
Yep.
You know, and as a young man, and I've talked about it before, you know, we have that conversation now because he's getting older and it's a hard thing for him to accept, but, you know, it's something I have to now carry for the rest of my life. They are my choices. But in saying that too, he's very proud of my story of redemption and where I am today. And to be where I am today, unfortunately, had to be a part of his life that I missed out of because of my bad choices.
Of course.
You know, you yourself, you've realised that obviously you needed a change and you went to rehab?
Yeah, well, yeah, I hit rehab and it was the worst place I'd ever experienced in my life when I first
really?
Went there. Oh, it was terrible. It was horrifying.
Why is that, Dean? Rehab's supposed to be a place where you heal yourself and, you know, people go for wellness. I understand that people go in there sick to start with. You know, we see the rehabs today and people reaching out and, you know, they're adamant. You've got to be clean for, I think it's a minimum of 14 days or something. Like, I don't understand today when someone's seriously had enough of their addictions and they're reaching out and knocking on door. We call it the help door.
Yep.
And yet they're turned away again. And, you know, you've got to sit out in the cold, so to speak, and go through it on your own. I get the logic behind it because it could be toxic to others in there.
Yep.
But how does one truly get the help that's required to better themselves when they're wanting to reach out. I mean, you know yourself, mate. You can only change when you want to change.
Yeah, for sure.
So, you know, for all those times you had a fucking shit day and you just felt fucked and you were like, I want to get off this. This is done. I'm over it.
Yeah, I had but those
you,
days.
But you weren't really, because tomorrow you get up and get on the gear again.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you knew you were going to get sick.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, but for that person that's literally gotten to that point and they are sick and they've had enough and they don't want to keep going out committing crimes and they want to find something in their life that has purpose. There's nothing, like, it's a tough road, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it is, but I think timing's a beautiful thing. And I think we all arrive at a crossroads in our life at some point and stage, but it's what you do with it when you arrive at those crossroads.
What did you do?
Well, I got it. And as soon as I got it, that was it. It was pretty quick for me. I'm a very fast learner.
When you say you got it, yeah. How does someone with a raging heroin habit, which their body's just soaked in it. You're talking about methadone, you're talking about heroin. Your bones are fucking drenched in you know, just toxic shit. Well, you are going to be a very ill man.
Oh, yeah, for sure. If I was dosed up like that when I got there. But no, I went there from jail. So
had you not used in jail?
I had, but I didn't have a habit. I was very fit and I was healthy and, you know. So I went there on a bail application. Because I'd just finished 3 years and I had 105 charges that there was a jurisdiction problem in respect to the DPP couldn't work out if they were to be heard in the Supreme Court or the District Court.
Yep.
And it kept getting swung in both jurisdictions.
Right.
And that took 3 years for them to sort that out.
So you hadn't even been sentenced at that stage. You were on remand.
On these 105, that's right, I was on remand. So I finished that three-year sentence. And then I was going to go back on remand. So I didn't want to go back on remand. I didn't want to go stay in custody. So I went up to a jail lawyer and I said to him, mate, can you do an application for me to the Supreme Court for bail? He said, bring me your record up tomorrow, Dean, and I'll have a look at it and we'll go from there. I took my record up to him and I went up there the next day and I said, how did you go? He's there at the fence, he said, Jesus, you've had a lot of failed to appears on here.
Yeah.
I said, oh, yeah. I said,
but that comes with the addiction as well, isn't it? You get out, you got a habit, you're not going to go back to fucking court.
Yeah, and he said, there's not a court in this land that's going to give you bail without any surety, Dean, you know that. Mm. He said, have you got any money? I went, fucking money? What's that? I said, I've got 20 cents in my property.
Yeah.
I said, get back to work at it. You'll find a way. And I was a bit aggressive because I wanted to get out.
Mm.
And I went over to the surgery and had something to eat. Anyway, next day he called me back to the fence. He said, mate, have you ever thought about a rehabilitation centre? I said, don't fucking swear at me.
So you were adamant that rehab was for fucking quitters?
Oh, yeah, and for dogs.
Yeah, okay. Like, so it was a shit place for shit people.
Shit go. You know, dogs, fucking telling on people all the time, you know, not loyal. Fucking no respect there, no honour there, no value in the people there, you know.
What changed your mind?
Well, what happened is I finally went up to the Supreme Court with that as a criterion condition for bail. And the judge, I'll never forget what he said to me, he looked me up and down, he said, you've dressed well, son. I said, thanks, Your Honour. He said, well, nothing else has worked for you, has it? I said... No, Your Honour. He said, well, hopefully this will work for you.
Gave you a break.
He gave me a break, and I got
and
there.
And to be honest, it's been the best break that you've ever been given, wasn't it?
Yeah, most definitely. But when I first got there, mate, I hated it. You know, like people, I just didn't want to be around people like that.
So your mindset was still, you're just fucking putrid cunts.
You're putrid cunts. Like, fucking just, get off. Stay away from me.
Yeah, you're fucking, grubs.
Don't fucking talk to me. Like, I don't want to fucking know you.
Because, yeah, I mean, look, and it's common knowledge that you hear people go to rehab and people are there to tell on people.
Yeah.
You know, if Johnny's got a smoke or fucking something that he's going to have and Barry sees it and Barry gets brownie points
exactly.
For telling on Johnny, doesn't
he? That's right.
And that's how it was.
Yeah.
It was always known that, you know,
and
you were risking it all if you went there to get given up.
And look at the environment we come from.
Mm.
That shit wasn't allowed.
Well, you just wouldn't have walked a yard.
You wouldn't have.
Especially back then. Though.
No, you would have been on protection.
Straight up.
So, when I'm there, they're talking and sharing their feelings, and they're all obedient. They're all cleaning and doing as they're told.
But you had no feelings. You were just a cold-hearted fucking criminal.
That's all I was. That's exactly what I was. And I remember going down this villa, and they're all cleaning it at 7 o'clock at night, and there was a girl there that I knew from the street. And they gave me a rag, and they said, clean the toilet. I said, fuck off, mate. I'm not cleaning the fucking toilet. You clean the toilet. Where's the gym?
So you've come out with the mindset that that jail head was still on your shoulders.
Oh, but never left me.
Yeah. You weren't, you know, you wouldn't have taken that from the screws or anyone else.
I wouldn't have. But the thing is, mate, I didn't go to this rehab to change. I went there to escape. I forgot to tell you, I went back to the yard after speaking to this jail lawyer, and I'm pulling cones in the yard with a heap of blokes, all right? I've just finished a game of touch football. I was sweating. And I was looking around this jar, and I was thinking, I'm fucking sick of this fucking joint, this fucking low fucking putrid joint.
Yep.
Look at this frigging mongrel joint. And I thought, fuck, if I get to that rehab, I'll be able to fuck off straight back to Melbourne. So my goal...
Your mindset was to get out and boot it.
Boot? Yeah. I'm off, mate. Yeah, fucking, you. I'm hasta la vista, baby. Yep. I'm gone. So I get there, and that's the intention.
That's a mentality of an addict.
Of course.
Habitual offender that's an addict.
Of course.
Why else would you think any other way?
Of course.
Especially after, what did you just do, 3 years?
3 years.
It's easy break. Have to climb the wall.
I'm going. I'm off. And I was going to knock off their bloody, their Toyota 12-seater.
Oh, just like Mount Penang, eh? Go and knock off the fucking bus from Mount Penang and down the Carrion Mountain you go with the Storm Boys chasing. Hey!
The old Storm Boys, eh? Haven't heard that one for a while. Yeah. Yeah.
I had a run down that mountain. Anyway, that's another story.
Yeah. It's a big mountain.
It's a big drop. Many a broken leg has come out of that hill.
Yeah.
Hey, but if you got the bottom into Gosford and the fucking Carrion, mate, you were sweet. You'd always find a car to get back to Sydney.
You would, mate, most definitely.
Mm.
So, yeah, so at that rehab, I had a moustache, and I used to feel really naked without this thing on my face. And the first day, we had this this community group every morning, and one of the higher members said, "Dean, you got to shave that moustache off." I said, "I'm not fucking shaving no moustache off." They said, "You're going back to jail if you don't do it." Anyway, I walked out of there, and some residents come out, and I shaved it off because, as I said, I wanted to run away. But yeah, I felt really bloody naked.
Did they have that over you though? That there was, you know, guidelines there for if you were to fail, it was a return to jail warrant.
Oh yeah, straight up. If you didn't toe the line, there was cardinal rules there. No violence, no threats of violence, no sex, or no knowing of the above. So. Anything being aggressive, and I was aggressive.
Yeah.
But I never physically acted out on people, thank God for that.
But verbally.
Oh, yeah, I was terrible. Yeah. I'll fucking bury you under that fucking tree down there, you fucking thing.
Oh, Dean, you still like that guy.
Oh,
I'm
feeling like...
Come on, mate. Let's go back to the census now. We're going to bring out today's Dean King in a second.
We'll bring out the loving side.
And we're going to bring out the loving and the Christianity side of this wonderful man. I think that's a really important thing that we'll talk about too.
Very much so.
So you've... I mean, the mindset's there, and I get it, and I'm sure those listening understand that now when you've explained that, because to a lot of people, I guess they wouldn't understand, why would you keep doing that?
Aye.
But that's all you knew.
It's all I knew.
Living life on the run, committing crimes and taking drugs,
that's
which you were extremely addicted to, and with a zero empathy for anything else.
No, I couldn't care.
What changed, Dean? Why did Gene... What was it, a fucking punch in the head? Was it, you know, something in the heart? What happened? What, talk to us.
Yeah, well, what happened, they were confronting me every day from 6 o'clock in the morning to when we went to sleep at night at 11 o'clock about how angry I was, how intimidating I was, how threatening I was, how aggressive I was.
So they were trying to help you?
They were. And I become really desensitized, and you know, I was holding a lot in. I couldn't deal with it. But this was like a fucking bomb growing up inside me, all this shit. And I'm really, really, really trying to hold this together, and it's getting harder and harder and harder.
You've never been put in this situation
in your life.
Pushed and drove that sensitivity from deep within.
Never.
And here you are.
I'm copping it.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, I'm going to get all their names off the electoral rolls. I'm going to square up on them. I'm going to hurt them. Yeah. I'm going to get them back for what they're doing to me. And one day I got a letter from, they used to get these little notes from the higher levels, and they used to give them to a guy called the Ramrod, and he used to go around the community giving them to people on work sites and stuff. And we're on this work site one day, and he's giving me this, the supervisor's giving me a note. And it said, where do you get off threatening people, intimidate people? You know, you think you're tough, but you're weak. And I just went fucking off.
Just to clear that up. So would you say that, was it like a blind sort of hat or something, and people put in, did you know where this question come from? Was it just the group could put in questions and directed at each individual with no name on it?
It was directed to specific people. Staff members used to do it.
But wouldn't sign anything. It was just purposely put there to get into your head.
To get a reaction. Everything they did, they were looking for emotional reaction so that you could deal with that emotional reaction.
Okay. And so there was a purpose.
There was a purpose in everything that they did. And I lost it. And I went off my head, and it's all in there. Everyone from the work site where we're working, they all bolted, right, and left all the shovels there and the picks and that. And I remember there was this big oak tree, and I went, fucking weak? I'll show you how fucking weak I am. I went up to this oak tree, and I just started going on this oak tree. And I'm going for about probably 6 or 7 minutes on it, like fucking everything
Your
I had.
Your knuckles would have been bleeding.
I was fucked. And I just started, the tears started coming down my face, you know. And I'm hitting it, 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 and I wouldn't stop hitting it. And one of the staff members just screamed out, stop doing it to yourself, Dean. You know, like, you've had enough. And
because you, like you said earlier in our chat, you hated you.
Hated myself, man.
You had no self-love.
No self-love. Hated myself. And I broke down and I cried and I couldn't stop and I cried for 10 hours. And whilst I was, it got to a stage where there was no water coming out my eyes. I was just hyperventilating. And I remember about 6 o'clock come around and a staff member was there and he was just rubbing me on the back, like really being supportive and caring. And I was really uncomfortable with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And but it was kind of soothing me.
You'd never had that
affection. I never had that affection from, especially a man.
Going back, had you experienced being abused as well earlier in the day? So, and I ask you that because of the sensitivity of, sorry, Dean's just fucking, turn your
mate.
Fucking phone off, mate. Gee willikers.
It's your kids, mate, I know.
Oh, okay, all right.
I'll turn it off.
Come on, mate.
Oh, no.
Dean comes for an interview and leaves his phone on.
Well, I thought I'd turn
Thanks for coming to the clink, mate. Anyway, we're going to just close this down. One of the most vulnerable parts of our chat, the most powerful turning of your life. Bloody phone. No. And look, it's for the kids,
it's
mate.
It's the kids.
Do you need to take it?
No, it's all good. All good. Oh, all cool, mate.
Okay.
Yeah, anyway, like I didn't know. But yeah, it felt good. I felt good. And he said, go and have a lay down, mate. And he put his arm around me and he walked me over to the villa. And he gave me a cuddle, and it felt nice, and I laid down, and I went to sleep, and I slept right through till 6 o'clock the next morning. And
peacefully for once in your life.
Oh, fuck. But no, I used to sleep good all the time.
Did you?
Yeah, all the time. But yeah, and I woke up, and my hands were so sore, and then when I got up, I remember standing, and I felt light.
Yeah.
I'd never felt that.
And powerful, huh?
And I went, this is good. I like it. And then something else came over me, and then I thought, you're good for everything, Dean. You're good for everything that you've done. And these people have have been trying to get you to take accountability for all of it, your thoughts, your behaviour, your actions.
So how long had you been there? Before, probably about three. And if, can I say this, before they broke you?
Because they broke me like a horse.
You were a wild horse.
I was a wild horse. I was a Brumby.
You just refused to have the fucking saddle put on.
Fucking oaf I did.
And all of a sudden, you're feeling a powerful emotion that you, which most humans have every day of their life.
Yeah.
You know, so we're aware of our emotions. I mean, we choose sometimes to block them out. We choose. You had no control. You didn't know what it was.
I had no filters.
This is all fresh. You're a grown man.
All fresh.
And you're experiencing something that most of us take for granted.
Vulnerability. I was vulnerable. My first time in my life, I felt vulnerable. And I loved it.
Yeah, amen, I loved brother. It. That's beautiful.
and when I got
seriously,
it.
That right there is powerful.
Yeah. And when I got it, I knew that that life was done. In that moment, I knew that was murdered. I knew I was never going to go back to that person. I love talking about my feelings. I love being open. I loved it. I loved it. I loved everything about the
I can see it in your eyes. And you know, we've had a good chuckle here so far, but I can see the passion in your eyes and your heart, and I can actually see that emotion. And you talk about an empty, dark-souled human.
Yeah.
So I look at a man that's just full of love and life.
Oh, for sure, now, man.
And that smile and you know, like your eyes are just full of life. I mean, I'm going through some personal issues at the moment. There are tough times. You know, the first thing you did was just chatting with me. You put your arm on me. Yeah, it's just smile, brother. It's all going to be good.
Yeah,
you know,
and
here you are sharing something that, you know, most people will never understand how powerful it had you, the hold that life had on you, to then now being able to sit here and say to someone with compassion, it'll be all right, mate.
Yeah, 100%. Because I care, like when I started really caring for myself and my own self worth, I care for people, mate.
Yeah,
you know, and it's just a byproduct. I really care for people, and that's why, you know, it took me 12 years to write that book. It's you know, I loved it. You know, I love. I love to love, and not just with girls and relating to sex or getting what I want. I like to see people, you know, improve themselves. I like to watch people grow within themselves.
Well, Dean, you're also a father.
Exactly.
You know, you are a role model to your young children.
Of course.
Well, we're not young, they're adults. But
yeah, they are.
They are young adults to which they look up to their dad.
Exactly.
And, you know, like I know from my oldest son who's 22, we can talk about anything.
Yeah.
You know, and it actually is really cool.
Yeah.
There's years that we lost because of my choices, but we're mates now.
Yeah.
You know, and I love my boy, and my boy loves me, and it's a powerful thing. You know, you've got two beautiful children that are young adults.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they don't ever have to fear of being honest with dad or asking anything. Or
never.
How do you find that with, you know, being that father? Showing
great.
Emotion.
Great.
Teaching love.
Great. Sensational. Love it. Love it. And they conduct their lives accordingly because of that. They're good people. You know, like,
it's our wrongs that make their rights. I've
exactly.
always said that, you know.
It's
if
so
I,
true.
If there's one thing I could say for the years that I wasn't present in my oldest son's life, I pray that my wrongs are his rights. And they are.
They
he's
are.
He's a success already,
they are.
You know, at 22. He's on a great path. I'm very proud of that.
Well, so you should be, because you're a good person.
I try. I mean, I've got my demons like everybody else.
I have
too.
You
know what I mean? They never go.
They will never go.
But, you know, we have, I guess, sometimes support networks or ways of dealing with things which we never would have known.
Yeah.
And, you know, you were obviously taught a lot back then about self-love.
Yeah, most definitely. And it was a process. It took me years. Like, you know, that was just the start of it. I knew that, you know, I had 26 years of conditioning I had to overcome.
Yeah.
So I was very clear on how long it was going to take.
It was like, a marathon.
It was going to be a marathon. Mm. But I have a lot of go in me, and that's a thing. And I knew it doesn't matter how long it took, I knew I was never going to go back to jail, nor I was going to be that person anymore. So it doesn't matter. I knew I've got a lifetime ahead of me to work it out. There's no
How
rush.
How powerful is that? Jeffrey Morgan that we've had on here as well is a wonderful Indigenous man who, mate, a powerful story of redemption, you know, and a success, from one of the best car thieves and bank robbers to, you know, an absolute leader in the community and his Indigenous community. And the one thing he loves to work with young people is you take their strengths and write their rights using their strengths.
Most definitely.
So, you know, you talk about you, the strength you would have had to have in the mindset every day to go and get your addiction.
Yep.
Go and get your fix.
Yep.
You know, the nous you would have had to find to not fear and get out there and get that car or make that earn, whatever it was that you were confronted with to be that hardened, thick-skinned criminal.
Yep.
Who was a raging junkie.
Yep.
If I can put it like that.
Exactly.
I mean, listen, I fucking bullshit.
Yeah, exactly.
You've flipped that and you've become an addict of life and love.
Of course.
And taken those strengths.
Yes.
And this is something that Jeffrey Morgan always talks about is, you know, if you get a young bloke that's a great car thief, well, don't try and change his life and get him to be something that he doesn't want to be. Bring him into something like a panel beating shop or something.
Exactly.
Give the guy, a bits and pieces job and say, now, mate, make it yours, you know.
Exactly.
And he will build a Ferrari out of it. You know what I mean? I'm not so much a Ferrari, but you know what I mean.
It's like, true.
You take that strength that they've already got, because what people don't realise is people have, and people like us that have had to walk these paths or chosen over our years to do certain things, you've got to be half smart for starters. Secondly, you've got to have plenty of ticker and go.
You do.
Now, if you can put that into a positive way of life, like you have,
yeah,
and I'm really proud to sit here and get to this part of the interview because it's a really, really strong power of redemption.
Very much so.
You know, off the back of, you know, such a very, very dark start.
Yeah, yeah. And as you were saying, if you can direct that, and I got that. I got that when I made the decision that I was accountable for everything in my life.
Self-acceptance?
Yeah, I got it. But I didn't get it straight away where I woke up one morning and my criticism was gone about myself, or my self-worth was gone about myself, or my anger was gone about myself, or my frustration was gone. I didn't take a pill, you know. This has taken friggin' 30 years to arrive. But during that time of learning about myself through all the different experiences and companies and people that I associate with and all the travels I've done all over the world and all the great things I've been blessed with in my life, I've learnt to better myself out of every incident that's happened to me by acknowledging the accountability. And ownership in everything.
Yep.
Everything. And I don't think I could have done that, Brent, without that ownership.
No.
I really don't, mate.
It doesn't balance.
Mate, I think I would have looked for a back door. Yeah.
Excuses.
I think I would have looked for an excuse, mate, where I don't. I stand up to the plate and I cop it on the chin and I take it. And, mate, I've got people that say, if you didn't go into this business, or you remember when I had the gyms or fucking printing companies, you know, you
were... But that's you. You're having a go.
Have a go.
That's you.
Have
you're
a
having
go.
A go.
Fucking
you're not
straight into
you're not
it.
Sitting there talking about
no,
it.
No, I won't
and
talk.
And I'm proof of what you're saying because, as I said, you and I have been mates for a long time and there's a lot of history that we know about each other. And 100%. One thing I can honestly say about you, when I got out of jail, you gave me a start. You gave me a job in a gym that you were part owner with.
Yep.
He was a bit bizarre, your business partner, but anyway, I won't go on about that at the moment. He was very unique.
In his own way.
Nothing like us, nothing like you.
No.
Fuck. Dead. But
chalk
anyway.
Cheese, eh?
Mate, I tell you what, if he could... Oh, anyway, fuck. He was special. But he had this business sense that he was... You know, going to make millions and millions out of this business. One thing I got to say is you overcome so many hurdles. I remember sitting in team meetings and I remember sitting in staff meetings and you would address us and the conversations and we'd look at, you know, what's working, what's not working. How can we better it?
Mm.
What are we doing wrong?
Yep.
You are an educated man, self-educated man and a success in what you've done.
Yep.
You've had failed attempts.
Heaps.
And you keep getting back up.
Heaps.
You've been knocked on your ass all your life. But you keep getting back up. Today, you've written a book.
Yeah.
Expressing and talking about the fight.
Yes.
That Dean King has had to go through to get to where you are today.
Yeah, interwoven with a funny story. I'm a larrikin. And when I wrote this book, I had a lady that helped me. And when I first gave her the manuscript, I gave it to her and I said, she had a read of it. I said, what do you think of it? She said, oh, there's a rough dime in it. I said, well, get to work on it. She said, I'm not writing it for you.
So the same attitude you gave that fucking jail solicitor, off you go, find a way.
Get away.
So you didn't change.
There's a will, there's a way.
Still that mindset.
Get on with it.
But you've converted that to business.
Of course. And I've been extremely successful in there.
What other businesses have you had that have been successful? And I mean, even ones that weren't so successful.
I've had a painting company. It fell over. I was in marketing for a long time, advertising,
yep.
Telemarketing. That was very, very successful. I created a massive property portfolio. Probably at its height was worth about $14 million. That was very successful. I got knocked around with the GFC with that, but back in 2007. So I lost.
What's the GFC?
The global financial crisis.
Sorry.
Yeah,
yep.
That's okay. Yeah, and I lost about $5 million off that, but I survived it. You know, I went through separations, and my partner got a $1 million home plus everything in it.
Yep.
I had printing companies. I did my ass on that. I probably put $800,000 into that. I had the gyms. I've had traffic control, labour hire, crane companies.
You've had a real fucking go.
Yeah.
Like, and all jokes aside.
On that. Yep.
Like, you've got to give you credit where credit's due. And I'm not pissing in your pocket here. You know, we can sit here and you can talk about things you did that weren't right.
Yeah.
You know, but you knew no different back then.
Yeah.
You have that choice today of what's right and what's wrong.
Yeah.
And since that day of you realising back in 89, was it?
Yep.
89, that was enough, and we're in 2021 now.
Yep.
Mate, that's a solid redemption right there.
Most definitely. Know,
and a successful redemption story.
It is.
A story that people could learn so much from, and in your book, King Hit, it is there to be told.
That's all there, mate.
And at the end of it, you also, too, you know, like to help people and motivate people through that journey too, don't you?
I love it. I love seeing people improve within their lives and them getting happy because I loved it when I got it. So I love seeing people.
You got a lot of gratitude, haven't you?
Heaps. And appreciation. You know, just appreciation and gratitude just for this. This is enough.
Yeah, and you know what? But I appreciate and look, no guest that comes onto the clink, you know, there's no monetary exchange. There's none. This is just a genuine, true story of people inspiring people through their own actions.
Yes.
I'm honoured for every guest that comes on here because I never started it to talk about my story of redemption. I started it because of my story of redemption and I wanted to give more to people out there who are struggling through people like yourself and all the wonderful guests that have come on the clink and their story of redemption because there is a lot out there.
There's heaps.
And, you know, let's be honest. People need to sometimes be smacked in the mouth, like you were smacked in the mouth,
yes.
Basically, for a wake-up call for
yes.
me.
Yes.
You know, I needed to do a 6-year sentence.
Yes.
And do it tough.
Yep.
To realise that, you know, my children and my life are more important than a cell.
Exactly.
You know, and it's so much more out there. And what advice would you give someone that was Dean back then now? Like, seriously,
yeah,
because
yeah.
You've lived it.
I have.
And I pray that, you know, whoever is hearing this out there that's struggling at the moment through addiction or, you know, going through tough times, I really hope that each of these episodes you're able to get something out of it that gives you a moment in your life to spark up and believe that there's something greater than where you're at the moment.
Well, Brent, you've created that, mate. And that's your passion, mate. Look what you're doing.
I love what I do.
You brought me on here, mate, you know, like, and you bring other people on
yeah.
here. You love it too, bro,
I
in
do.
Your own way. You're the same as me, mate.
I love the fact
you
that
know,
people reach out and connect and say, listen,
definitely.
The clink has had this effect on
Fuck
my life.
Yeah.
But I, you know, like I said to you, there's people out there that'll have a little bit of a Karen, is it? Is
yeah.
that what we call it today? A little
yeah,
bit of a Karen.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And they'll put a comment that it's glorifying and grubby and disgusting and... And I sit back and go, fuck, you actually haven't listened to it. Because if you had listened to each of these episodes, you would truly respect the person's story and the journey of the guest. Because for what they've gone through to where they are today, like yourself,
yeah,
it's commendable.
And the other thing too, Brent, you wouldn't have anyone on here other than that.
I don't
You wouldn't create that.
But
you,
it needs to be an impacting story
exactly,
of redemption.
Exactly. And if somebody come on here and was glorifying crime, as you were saying, or speaking out their butt or trying to bridge up, you would pick that up and you'd just go bang.
It's funny you say that, and I'm not gonna pump up the particular name, but there is somebody at the moment that everyone keeps saying, oh, get him on. Sorry, guys, too. There's a bit of rain in the studio at the moment. You can hear it on the roof. We're being blessed with a bit of precipitation.
Thank God.
Amen to that. You know, like, and I'm very direct about that. My first question is, what is this person's story of redemption?
Exactly.
Oh, but, mate, I don't give a fuck whether you've got 150,000 followers, a million followers. If you haven't got something that's going to change the life of somebody in a positive way, I don't want to know about it.
Exactly, Brent.
But when you do, my door will be open.
Yes.
Because we are those people.
Of course you are. And ever since I've known you, that's who you've been.
Yeah.
See, I never knew you back in the day.
Yeah.
I could imagine what you were like.
Yeah.
Very similar to me.
Yeah.
But ever since I've known you, mate, your heart has been so far out there for your family, your children. I've met your kids.
Yes.
I've met your wife. Mate, you're a good man. And, mate, you've changed. You've made a lot of changes in your life. And, mate, doing this, this is frigging commendable. It's fucking sensational. That you're spruiking this and you're getting good quality people on here too.
But the thing is, Dean, it's people like yourself, and I'll say it again, there's no bullshit.
No bullshit.
There's no skeletons.
Nah.
We can all talk open. And, you know, like, people can't, the media can't come on and pull apart me or my guests, because it is what it is.
It is, bro.
Like it or lump it. Yeah. You know, if you don't like it, change the channel.
Exactly.
We do that at home. You don't like the fucking TV show, you change the channel. Don't sit there and tell me, you know, if it's constructive, I want to know about it, you know. But if you just all out, you know, crusader to be on the Mary Jones fucking Karen, whatever it is, you know, and you want to sit there and belittle them. Well, you know, maybe take time out and sit down and listen to it, because then it might change that person's life.
Exactly.
Dean, if we could leave a couple of words today. Well, no, let's not. Look, I want to ask you, where can we get your book from?
www.kinghitbook.com. You can buy the e-book there. There will be an audio book there after the 24th, probably 2 weeks after the 24th, there'll be the audio book. So if people struggle to read a bit, they can...
I won't lie, mate. Unless I really connect with a book, I struggle, because
sure,
I end up reading paragraph over and over again, and it's something I've never been... I think I've read 3 books in my life.
Yeah.
But I will be reading this, even though I know of you, and I know there's more stories in
there's
here.
There's heaps in there.
And I really feel too, guys, that if you want more of Dean's stories, both the good, bad, and the ugly, and to where you are today, and I'm sure it has the actual complete redemption story in here.
Everything. Complete redemption, mate.
Dean, every one of my guests, I ask the question, if you could leave an inspiring paragraph, sentence, some words...
Yep.
Before the thunder strikes and this rain smashes us down, what would you say to someone out there?
Mate, I would say take complete accountability for your thoughts, your behaviour, your actions. By the grace of God, if you're aware of being a victim, don't blame anyone for your situation. Understand that you've had a part to play in everything that you've done. And by understanding that and knowing that, that allows you to change it. If you don't know that, you know that now. So you have a choice.
Amen, brother. Dean King,
it's been an
absolute honour, mate. Thank you very much.
Good
and wishing you all the best in your future successes. There you have it. What a remarkable story of redemption. Guys, get at me if you're interested in getting Dean's book. Other than that, thank you all for listening this afternoon. It's about a pour here on the Gold Coast, and we're signing out. This is the Clink Stories of Redemption.
For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable.
That's right.
For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you.
That's right.
For the record, lab on me going all the way.
All the way.
For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste.
Stop calling.
For the record, 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 for the record.
We'll be right back.
Want to thank a new sponsor who's just come on board, Dr. Pickles Tattoo Aftercare and Lifestyle Products. They're made in Brisbane and are known right around the world. They have this amazing balm. It's called the Original Tattoo Balm. You seal and protect your tattoo with the OG. I've just been using it on my leg after I had it done, and I tell you now, my skin feels amazing and there's a great shine to it. They also have an antiseptic spray you can spray on and wipe over your tattoo to keep it nice and clean so you don't get any infections. They've got a 3-in-1 wash. It's all natural, smells great, packed full of peppermint, citrus, and wait for it, hemp oils. How good is that? Plus, they have a SPF 50 sunscreen, which acts as a moisturizer as well as protecting your tattoos from fading and stop them from getting sun damage. Right now, though, for the Clink listeners, they're offering 15% off with the code CLINK. Just head to drpickles.com. That's drpickles.com.